And Narada understood, or actually Narada was testing him. Then later on he instructed him and how to actually fulfill his desires through the process of meditation. So now it appears that he's also reverting back to his old consciousness of revengefulness after becoming purified by seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So can we say that he was actually fully purified from all material, what we say, residue of any kind of desires? Obviously it was, but in a sense, another sense it mentions, of course it mentions a little later on, that he wanted to show that his love for his brother was actually real. And so in order to do that, it appears that he wanted to not just, well, we say, take a little action, but he wanted to show his complete love for his brother by acting in this way. And of course, it takes a form of some kind of violence. But a kshatriya is accustomed to violence. But then we find in this purport, it's quite ambiguous. Not ambiguous, it's more like ambivalent. You got two aspects of life here. You got violence, which is justifiable, and violence, which is not justifiable. There's people who are what we call pacifists, or people who adhere to the principles of nonviolence as an absolute principle and under all and every conditions. Prabhupada was talking about politics one time, and he was talking about how, you know, politics works. And then Prabhupada was saying, well, politics is based on violence. You know, without violence. And he criticized Mahatma Gandhi. He said, actually, Mahatma Gandhi didn't drive the British out of India. It was Subhas Chandra Bose who did it. Gandhi, for 30 years, was trying, and he got very little. He got some reason. Some advancement in the sense that he got a large following, but the British were still entrenched. It was only until Subhas Chandra Bose made a deal with the Germans and the Japanese to bring back the soldiers that were captured by them in the war and then use them to fight against the British. And by doing that, they drove out the British from India. That's the actual history. We don't hear too much about that. So when Prabhupada's talking about this and describing it in detail, and he's actually saying that, so politics and violence is necessary. So one devotee says, does that mean we can use violence? Prabhupada said, no, Krishna consciousness is love. It's not violence. So sometimes we find that violence is only used in a loving society as a means for protection. Because when I gave that example the other day, where I actually said this story, where there was one great proponent of nonviolence, who under no conditions would he be ever be induced to act in a violent way. And he was famous for this, and he spoke about it, he wrote about it, and he became known as a complete person who is nonviolent. But one reporter came to him and said, my dear sir, we see you have a daughter. So if someone comes to, violate your daughter or to cause harm to your daughter, what will you do if you're there? He said, under no conditions will I be violent. And the porter persisted, and he kept with the same principle. I will never become violent in no conditions. And the reporter said, my dear sir, you're violent. Because you fail to protect the innocent, which is another form of acquiescence or acknowledging that violence is okay. So, yeah. So their violence is allowed in order, as Prabhupada says here, for organizing state authority, because there's dacoits, there's thieves, there's rogues who cause problems to the innocent population. And therefore, there must be a system of law and order. Otherwise, how can society go on? This is the material world. Material world means a place of constant disturbances. There's always disturbance, even if you don't want them. Prabhupada mentions here that, you know, people are allowing or maintaining slaughterhouses in order to kill animals, in order to, find that as a necessary foodstuffs for the general population. Of course, it's a big economic adventure, and people are making billions of dollars on this. And so it's more about economics than about it is about eating meat. But because people want to eat meat, you know, the economic situation is flourishing. So, but here, and it says that when these things happen, then gradually, over a period of time, as karma builds up, a society will be faced with war. George Bernard Shaw, one great philanthropist, he wrote one poem. And he says, you know, we sit at the table and we eat our food, and we're actually, our bodies are becoming graveyards for the animals. But what is the result of that? And then there is war. There is war. He actually understood the karmic reaction. So we see, just like I've been, you know, every once in a while I pop on the news to see what's happening in the land of America. And just yesterday, there was three shootings, wanton shootings. Somebody just went crazy. There was a whole gun battle in one city in the United States. They were just fighting with the police. It was like a war. It went on for a half hour. The police couldn't even stop these guys. It was only two guys with automatic rifles, and they had hand grenades too. Now this is going on in the cities of America, and at the same day, it happened in two other places throughout America. So you're thinking, the people think, well, why is this happening? And I was thinking, for years, the United States has been going into other countries and overthrowing governments and causing violence in countries. They've been doing it for the last 50 years in countries around the world. And now it's coming back, you know. Karma comes back. What goes around comes around, they say, right? So people can't understand why these things happen. But then you have to look, what is the lifestyle of the people in general? And therefore, there's always a reaction for everything. So Prabhupada makes that point. But violence has its place only for, what we say, curbing the miscreants and protecting the innocents. So we see here in this situation, it's not the case. And of course, Prabhupada seems to be a little bit one-sided or another. He says, you know, Dhruva Maharaj is killing unnecessarily, and this is offenses. This is great offense, but actually he's a great devotee. He's a great devotee. And because he's a great devotee, he was saved from further reactions of sinful activities. So Svayambhuva Manu, who's in charge with law and order in the universe, had to step in and stop Dhruva. But Dhruva, you know, sometimes when a person becomes afflicted by anger, they can't hear any good instructions. They say like that because that anger seems to cause one to become, as that verse says, you lose one's intelligence. An anger becomes such a destructive force that it becomes something that is unstoppable in certain cases. Many cases, most cases. But Dhruva Maharaj, he listened. Although he was battling these yaksas and killing them, when he was approached by a senior person, he listened. So this is his good quality. He understood that it was time now to stop, and he took the advice. So one may be sometimes acting in the wrong way, but if one receives knowledge or good advice and accepts that, then that person can be forgiven. Just like I see in a lot of times when you do something wrong, if you try to defend yourself, when you do something wrong, what happens? You get a greater punishment. If you admit you're wrong, Even for the, you see that people automatically let off. In other words, they don't, oh, he's sorry for doing wrong. Okay, like that. Just like I've seen it so many times when police arrest people. We got arrested so many times doing Sankirtan. You know, as soon as you resist, it gets worse. As soon as you, you know, submit, then it's a whole different mood. So in the same way, but a lot of times because of the nature of that desire, it becomes unstoppable like that. Especially for a Kshatriya who's accustomed to fighting. But we find here that, and Prabhupada also makes the point, you know, sometimes because of one person, so many people have to suffer. Is that suffering justifiable? On one level, it looks like it's not. On another level, there is nothing happens by accident. Every cause has a remote and an immediate factor in it. The immediate is what you see. The remote is behind the scenes. So just like we under, when Dhritarashtra, he approached Krishna at the end of the battle of Kurukshetra. His 100 sons had been killed, and he approached Krishna and he wanted to know why, you know. He said, you know, I was born blind. I had 100 sons. They all died in battle. Can you tell me my karma? And Krishna said, 50 lives ago, you were a hunter. And you shot a flaming arrow into a nest of birds. There was 100 birds in the nest. And all the birds die, but the mother bird got away, but she was blinded by the fire. So Krishna revealed. So then Dhritarashtra said, oh, 50 lives ago. Why 50 lives ago? And Krishna said, it took you that much time to get that much good karma to have 100 sons. And then just like if you have to pay a debt and you don't have the money, you know, they keep sending you notices until you get the money and then you can pay. So when the karmic comes to a certain level, then it cashes in at a certain time. Just like this one man, he wrote this one book. One of the most famous best-selling books ever in the existence of books. Why do bad things happen to good people? It was the number one bestseller in America for decades. And he came up with this theory. What was his theory? He was a rabbi. His name was Dr. Kushner. He was a rabbi. He had a son. His son was born with a very rare disease called progeria. Now, progeria is very rare, but it's there. And what is the effects of this disease is that a person goes through their whole lifespan in a short period of time. So his son died of old age at the age of 14. He had all the symptoms of old age at 14 years old. Very rare disease. It comes from Africa, actually. And so when he saw that, he was thinking, you know, I'm a rabbi and this young boy is so innocent. Why? I'm a man of God. I believe in God. God is good. So he wanted to rationalize, you know, what happened. And finally, he came up with some rationale. And his rationale was that God is all good, but he's not all powerful. He's not all powerful. He's got a lot going. There's so many things he has to, you know, maybe some of his secretaries are out to lunch and they miss some of the things. What is that verse? Parashya Shakta Virahaya Suyate Svabhavika Gyala Balakriya Cha. So maybe one of the energies took a break. So he came up with this idea that God is, he's good. We have to understand God is good. So we should, you know, love God because he's good. But, you know, he's not all powerful. And he misses a few things here and there. So because of that, you know, good people are subjected to these terrible turmoils in life. And he wrote this book based on that whole principle. and giving personal, you know, he talked about so many stories of people who had similar situations. And the book was so popular that people were buying it. Here's the answer to the question. And they made a whole thing around this called theodicy. The Christians have this term called theodicy. What is it, and how does God relate to people in this material world? This is the whole science of theodicy. And they can't understand the relationship with God. So they hypothesize based on what we call empirical studies and come up with some idea of what God is like and how he relates to others. But everything is clear in the Shastras. And Krishna says, yayatam mam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajami aham mama vartmana vartante manusha partha sarvasyaham. So, but people can't see because they only see within a certain spectrum. Therefore, things happen by the way of karma collection. So we wrote a response to that book. Actually, His Grace Ravindra Swarup Prabhu wrote a response to that book and saying that, you know, bad things don't happen to good people. Bad things happen to bad people. And good things happen to good people. But we have to see that this is not our first life. And then he explained the whole science of transmigration of the soul from one body to another, which is not so much understood or even accepted. I remember I went to one college one time. It was two philosophy classes. It was about 150 students. The two student teachers came together, and I gave a talk on reincarnation and karma. Reincarnation and karma. And the teachers were fired up. They wanted their students to hear this. This was a Christian college, strictly a Christian college. I forgot the name of it, Saint something. So I gave my thing, and the professors were right there. The students were a little bewildered because, you know. And finally I ended, got good questions, was thanked by the professor. And then I'm leaving, and I'm on my way, and I get to my automobile. I get in, and one irate student, he comes running up to me. He was a little older. He said, how can you speak this? This is not true. Where did you get all this stuff from? How did they allow this in colleges? And he was really angry at me. I was just saying, well, you can blame your teachers because they actually, you know, I couldn't logically philosophize with him. It wouldn't have been any good because he wasn't ready to hear anything. He just wanted to vent his, he was so angry. So the people, they have this idea that, you know, that there's one life. Because the Christian understanding is, if you say that there's more than one life, that makes you relax. You don't try hard to become God conscious. Oh, all right, if I don't make it this life, you know, could do it later, next life. But if you say it's one life, then you got to really go for it, right? So that's their philosophy. Makes sense? Does it make sense? For an ignorant person, it does. But for someone who's intelligent, it doesn't make sense. Because an intelligent person will understand that you can't somehow or other not try, because if you're not trying, you're going the other way. You don't stay in one place and then just pick up whenever you start. You either are moving forward or you're moving backward. That's the nature of life. If we're not struggling to become Krishna conscious, we're moving towards the material energy. And that struggle is good, because it's actually the principle of our desire to achieve success. So, yeah, this karmic thing, we cannot see how it manifests, but we understand by the principles taught by the scriptures. But there are many, many examples. There's a whole class of people in one area of the world. It's right near Israel. The people are called the Druze. I don't know if you heard of them. D-R-U-Z-E. They have a high rate of understanding of reincarnation. When we were distributing our books in there, that area, they were buying our books like crazy. And they said, this is our philosophy. And they're somewhat, they're a combination of, they're connected with Israel, but they also have some Islamic tradition or connection also. There's a combination. And many of their children can remember their past lives. And they speak about it. And so when the children have a tendency to remember past lives. When you get older, you kind of like your mind changes and you're more or less focused on the present. But when you're less impressionable, I mean, you're more impressionable when you're young, and therefore your mind is more pure. At least you haven't, your desires haven't manifested at the early ages in life. So children remember their last life. I was just reading an article, and about a couple months ago, one young boy in Australia, he claims to be Princess Diana in a previous life. I mean, Princess Diana, she died in a car accident about 30 years ago, something like that. And this boy can remember so many things of the life of Princess Diana. He even remembers when he was dying. And he talks about that just before he dies. So he's 4 years old. He lives in Australia. And so this made the newspapers. And then they take the comments from the people about, you know, what do you think about this, you know. And everybody is negative. Or at least they only take the negative comments because they don't want to propagate this idea of reincarnation because it goes against the Judeo-Christian teachings. But actually, the real Judeo-Christian teachings is that Christ also spoke about reincarnation. And that's a whole nother subject. But they push it out. In the Council of Nicaea in the year 555, one emperor, Justinian, his wife mostly, she was the, protagonist. And she immediately got rid of this idea of reincarnation from Christian teachings. Before that, it was there for the first 500 years A.D., So therefore, even now, people are so bewildered about what's happening in the world because they think everything is within the certain context, or they see it, and they don't realize that, you know, people are living life after life after life, and the whole science of karma and reaction is very intricate. And Krishna even says, no one can understand the workings of karma. It's so difficult to understand. But if you read some of the Puranas, especially the Garuda Purana, it gets right details about how people are situated in this life and basically on what they had done in previous lives to give them that situation. It gets into real details. So if you study the Vedas really scrutinizingly, you can find a lot of this information. But the point is made that people are in ignorance about what's happening and why it's happening. Why? Because they can't see the big picture. Can't see the big picture. And therefore, they don't see the connection between violence and the reaction of the violence. They don't see the reaction. Gradually, this knowledge is starting to come out. That's why Prabhupada said, you know, we have to propagate this knowledge everywhere because people are in ignorance. And when ignorance is the cause of suffering. People, why do people suffer? Because they're ignorant. Prabhupada said a child doesn't know, sticks his hand in the fire. The child is ignorant, it gets burned. The fire does not make the distinction between the child and the fact that the child doesn't know. The laws of material nature will work in such a way that even though people have good intentions, if they are acting in the wrong way, they get a reaction for that. So this law of karma is very, what we say, exact. Of course, there is a principle called mercy. For those who actually pray to God and worship God, then God can intervene and change a person's karma. And that's the principle of devotion, the principle of bhakti, like that. That happens after the fact, usually. People only turn to God when they're in a mess. Before the mess, they think everything's okay. And then when things happen, then people run and start calling out to God. And even devotees, we find that. Sometimes we forget that this material world is a dangerous place. Padam padam yad vipadam. That at any step, anything. Prabhupada is on a morning walk in Denver, Colorado, 1975. And they're walking through a very nice park. And Prabhupada's talking about, you know, how nice this place is. But then he said the material world is such that at any second this whole thing could be on fire and everything could change. He says this is the nature, this world is just so precarious. It's a dangerous place. So therefore, one who is actually in knowledge will understand one should always be connected to Krishna in devotion, because at any step, it says in the Vishnu Purana, what is the greatest anomaly? What is the greatest mistake? What is the greatest misfortune? The word greatest is used, is to forget the Supreme Personality of Godhead for 1 second, for one moment. That's the actual statement. So it seems like a little bit of a euphemism, or not of a euphemism, but a hyperbole, using really, really, really strong words to make a point. Sometimes people say Shastra is like that, Scripture is like that. The Scripture doesn't really tell it as it is. They just speak in these really grandiose terms just to get you to do what they want you to do, or to teach you what they want you to teach you. But actually, it's not like that. It's not like that. As Prabhupada said, it's actually an underestimation. It's an underestimate. I like Radhana Swami has this nice point. He makes it. He says, you know, little toe on your foot. It's, you know, how much pleasure can that little toe give you? But how much pain can it give you? So, you know, there's not much pleasure in your little toe, but pain. So this is the nature of this material. Well, devotees know that, but sometimes we forget that. So devotees are not worried about pain. They're worried about forgetting Krishna, because by forgetting Krishna, we put ourselves in a situation where anything could happen. Anything could happen as soon as you forget Krishna. But of course, Krishna is very merciful. For a devotee who is giving their life to serve, Krishna will never let them forget. One devotee said to Srila Prabhupada, I'm out distributing books, Srila Prabhupada, and I'm trying to give the books to these non-devotees. And what happens if I die when I'm distributing books and I don't remember Krishna? Prabhupada's response was, Lord Chaitanya will force himself into your consciousness. So for a devotee, there's always a lot of mercy, of one is even if one forgets Krishna, but still don't take a chance. Don't want to take a chance. And you see, as soon as you forget Krishna, something could happen and does happen. And sometimes when you remember Krishna, something that could have happened, you avoided that just by the remembrance of Krishna. Prabhupada said, if you remember Krishna, there's no pain. There's no pain. I've seen that too. Sometimes you smack your foot really hard, but you're chanting, and there's hardly any pain. And sometimes you just hit it easy, and you forget Krishna, and there's a lot of pain. It's just the way life is, that the spirit, when we're connected to the material energy, there's a whole series of laws that are in process. And as soon as we connect with Krishna, those laws are no longer effective, at least to the complete degree that they operate. So this is interesting here, how one person, Prabhupada makes this point over and over again, in this verse and in the previous, how one person can cause such devastation that so many people suffer because of that, due to the connection. I think I mentioned in yesterday's class how when Lord Nityananda was traveling, he came to the house of Ramachandra Khan. And Ramachandra Khan had been trying to vilify and destroy Srila Haridas Thakur, but he was unsuccessful by sending a prostitute, the best of all prostitutes, to make him fall down. But Haridas was fixed in chanting of the holy names. And not only did he not fall down, but he actually purified the prostitute and brought her to the level of chanting on the same amount of rounds that he was chanting. Now, but, you know, Ramachandra Khan committed an offense. And so now Lord Nityananda comes, and he comes to the place of Ramachandra Khan. He's with a few of his associates. He says to his associates, announce to Ramachandra that Lord Nityananda is here. So the word goes back, and then Ramachandra sends word back saying that Lord Nityananda, he can stay in the cowshed, which was an insult. He can stay in the cowshed. He didn't even come out to greet him. So Lord Nityananda immediately laughed, but he laughed in a different way. He laughed in anger. His laughter was not about, you know, something humorous. It was about anger. Sometimes the Lord will laugh in anger. He did that three times. At least we have it in the scriptures. Where Lord Balaram wanted to approach the crews after they stole, you know, captured Samba. He came to ask for Samba back, but they didn't want to give him. So he became angry and laughed in anger and took his plowshare out and started pulling the whole city of Hastinapur into the sea. And then they woke up and started offering beautiful prayers to Lord Balaram. The second time, another time, was when Lord Nisringadev appeared to Hirani Kashipu. He laughed in anger also. So the Lord laughs. So Nityananda did this. And then he left. And just after that, the leading mullock, the head Islamic leader, he came to the place of Ramachandra Khan, and he killed a cow and then destroyed Ramachandra's property, captured Ramachandra, put him in jail, and plundered the whole village in the area, just because of the offense of Ramachandra Khan. The whole village also became plundered because. So here's an example how when one person does something, those persons who are connected may also find a reaction. So the question is it their karma or not their karma? Or is it just their connection with him? Well, the connection with him is their karma. So because they're connected with him, that was their karma. So yeah. So we see that happens a lot. Someone kills a big person in one country, and then the country that person is from becomes attacked by that other country. So we find that happens a lot in politics. Okay, well, the point is here that violence is not wrong when it's used for its, what we say, the principles that it's meant to be used for, to protect the innocent and to, what we say, to chastise the miscreants like that. Any questions or comments? Yes, Nimai.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Thank you very much, Maharaj. This is a question which I've had for many times actually in the past. You mentioned this point about how Dhruva Maharaj was, he's still seen as a pure devotee. Prabhupada also is pardoning him for this apparent thing. And this is a worldview that we see, a value system that we see in the Vedic worldview, where the punishment is given based on the, not on the intensity of the crime, but on the intent of the criminal. But today we live in this egalitarian society where we want to put one rule for everyone. Even in our spiritual organizations also, not just in terms of general world, but even in spiritual organizations, we end up having these rules. And if sometimes a very advanced devotee or a sincere devotee may make a mistake, the masses tend to protest for equal justice and so on. So how can we change this skewed value system in the modern society, at least in our own spiritual organizations?
Where you go back to the intent rather than the result. Well, that's still there in some cases, but it's been being gradually eroded because they find it's too difficult. And people want to react. There was a rock and roll song. Oh Lord, what is it? How's that go, that song? Oh Lord, my intentions are good. Please don't let me be misunderstood. Yeah, that's basically the line in the song. That misunderstanding is more prominent than understanding. To make things understandable, it really takes time and attention and arrangements. Have you ever gone back and forth on emails? How much misunderstanding is there? I stop that. I mean, you say something and the whole thing is twisted out of context completely. Or you judge something through the email. Yeah. It's just like, because emails are just impersonal. And that seems to be an easy way to speak and an easy way to, you know, to vent your ideas, anger, whatever. How to come back to that? I think the answer is in the question. It takes some consideration that the intent and the results should be seen together and not just the results. I don't think you can just say just the intent. You have to say, I would say, because people will not accept just the intent. Because even if people have good intentions, and they act wrongly, there's going to be some problem to that. Prabhupada talks about this, where there was one young boy and his mother died. So now he's being taken care of by his auntie. And so his auntie is really doesn't want to discipline the boy. He's young. He's a young boy. He's a child, actually. And so she lets him do whatever he wants. And the kid's quite naughty. So he steals things from time to time and he acts in the wrong way. But she didn't discipline him at all. She thought, oh, I shouldn't discipline him. You know, there was some kind of sentiment there that, you know, I love him, therefore I don't want to make him feel bad by me chastising him. So she didn't. And then he grew up like that. And finally, when he got older, he committed a murder. And then he's brought to court and he's sentenced by the judge to death. And then his auntie's in the courtroom and she's crying. And so the boy says to the judge, he's a man now, before I go, can I speak to my auntie? And the judge granted it. So he went over there and she's crying. He comes real close to her and as hard as he can, he bites her on the ear. And she jumps back and she's surprised. And he said, now you're crying, it's too late. If you would have taught me what was right, then this would never have happened. So Prabhupada tells that story, misplaced sentiment. So even though her intentions were that, oh, I don't want to, you know, have a wrong attitude towards this boy, I want to just show him the good side of love, not the other side. Well, the boy grew up in the wrong way. So, her intentions were good, but they were wrong. Apparently good, you might say. Misplaced intentions. Prabhupada tells the same story again, or same point again. One boy, he has, what is that? That one disease? Where you can't eat. Huh? No, it comes from under-eating. What is that one? Tuberculosis. Yeah, he has tuberculosis. So he's 3 years old. Doctor says don't feed him because if you feed him, he'll die. So his mother's there and she's following it very carefully. So she goes, has to go out, and she says to her daughter, who's 11 years old, when your little brother cries, he's going to cry and ask for something to eat. Don't give it to him because he could get very sick and die. So she hears and then the mother leaves and then the boy immediately starts asking, give me paratas. And so she's crying, I want paratas. So his sister, she forgets or doesn't want to remember and starts cooking paratas and feeds it to the boy. And then the mother comes back and sees what happened and she starts chastising her daughter. The daughter's crying. And the daughter can't understand why she's being chastised. The boy didn't die, but the point was that Prabhupada made that point, misplaced sentiment. That the sentiment is there, but it's misplaced. So people may have good intentions, but if they act wrongly, they cause problems. So your point is taken, but it really has to be analyzed, each and every case. You can't just allow that. Just like Prabhupada talks about this other story where one man, he committed a crime, so he plead madness. I was mad when I did it. So they had this counselor there. He was a psychologist. So they brought it to his attention. And the man said, as far as I can see, everybody is mad. The whole world is mad. So people were claiming to be mad. So the point is that if apparently innocent people are victimized by a people who have good intentions, should we completely relieve that person of any reaction? Should justice not go that far? Mm-hmm. I think there should be some leniency on how the punishment is given, but still punishment is required. In other words, if there is a certain set punishment for a certain crime, for a person who's been judged that it was a mistake, wrong intentions, then and he pleads forgiveness, throws himself on the mercy of the court, there can be a mitigation of the sentence. And that's what usually happens like that. But dealing on a one-to-one basis in the society where there's no legal arrangements, that even with good intentions, it's not completely exonerated simply by saying, well, I had good intentions. You know? Even if it's an honest thing, still. And Prabhupada says, ignorance is the law is no excuse. Yeah. That's why we have to learn. That's why we have all this knowledge out of our... We're not only... There's many societies who perform bhakti, but they don't have much knowledge to support their bhakti. It's a lot of sentiment, and good sentiment, but because the knowledge is either lacking or incomplete, you know, they allow for deviations to come in the name of bhakti. Yeah, Prabhupada talks this a lot. And they say, oh, you know, the animals have no soul. Yeah, they say that. The Christians used to say that. The animals have, well, they still do. And that went all the way back to St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. But St. Augustine, he even said women had no soul. Yeah, he wrote a book. You can read it. And then, of course, that was later changed. So at least they accept that much, anyway. But they say, you know, animals have no soul. And Prabhupada said, what is the symptom of the soul? And then you can understand by symptoms, not simply by, well, because it's a different species, therefore, yeah, souls are only in human bodies. So we find that there's other traditions that have bhakti to some degree, but no real gyan to support that bhakti. And therefore, their bhakti becomes disturbed by the lack of proper activity or wrong activity. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.